We are back. This is the 20-Minute VC with me, Harry Stebbings, and following our incredible episode with Spotify founder and CEO Daniel Ek on Monday, we return to the wonderful world of venture with a legend of the industry. He's been in venture for the same amount of time I've been on Earth, and just a wonderful, wonderful person. And so with that, I'm very excited to welcome Scott Sandell, Managing General Partner at NEA, one of the leading firms of the last three decades, with now $23 billion under management. And since joining the firm in 1996, Scott has led investments in many industry-transforming technology companies, including Salesforce, Tableau Software, Webex, and Workday, to name a few. Scott also serves on the boards of rocket ships, including Robinhood, Cloudflare, Coursera, and Divi. And as a result of his incredible investing success, Scott is among the most frequently named VCs to the Forbes Midas list. And I'd also want to say a huge thank you to Rick Yang and Vanessa Larker at NEA, Armad at One Concern, Blake at Divi, Lily at Transfix, and Hicham at Enigma for some amazing input on the schedule today. Really a team effort there, and I so appreciate that. But before we dive into the show today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans? This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carta makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll, and for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carta. Whether you're just starting out or getting ready to go public, the team at Carta can help. Learn more at carta.com. And speaking of amazing products with Carta there, Founders Fund's Keith Raboy believes that the best way to run finance at any growing company is to adopt Ramp, the fastest growing corporate card in America. Join thousands of founders and finance leaders at leading companies like Roman and 8Sleep, cutting their bills by 4% per year and automating their accounting. In under 12 minutes, Ramp can empower your company to issue unlimited virtual and physical cards with built-in spend limits, 30-day payment cycles, and 1.5% cashback on everything you buy. Ramp is giving away a $500 welcome bonus just for 20 VC listeners. Just go to ramp.com/partners/20VC to receive the offer. Time is money, so save both with Ramp. And last but by no means least, SecureFrame helps companies get enterprise ready by streamlining SOC 2 and ISO 27001 compliance. SecureFrame allows companies to get compliant within weeks rather than painful months. Join companies like Stream, Hasura, Benepass, and unlock more sales with SecureFrame. 20 VC listeners get a whopping 10% off at SecureFrame.com/20VC. But that's enough from me. So now I'm very, very excited to hand over to Scott Sandell, Managing General Partner at NEA.
3, 2, 1, 0. You have now arrived at your destination.
Scott, I could not be more excited to have you on the show today. I've heard so many great things from Rick and Vanessa on your team. So thank you so much for joining me today, Scott.
Oh, well, Harry, I'm thrilled to be here. Your show is such a wonderful show, and I'm honored to be with you today.
Well, that is so kind of you. But I would love to start with a little bit on you. So tell me, how did you make your way into what I call the wonderful world of venture? And how did you come to be managing general partner at one of the most iconic firms that we have today in NEA?
Well, obviously, a lot of good luck along the way. But the story is back in 1996, when I first had the chance to join NEA, people didn't think about joining a venture firm by design. They just got lucky. There were only a few jobs available in the whole industry in a given year. People didn't plan on having a career in venture capital, but some of us were lucky enough to be asked. And in my case, what happened was I had left Microsoft and I was doing some consulting work for a company. They asked me to help them pitch venture capitalists. This is before the day of video conferencing. So NEA had an office in Baltimore and an office in Menlo Park. And someone introduced us to the NEA team in Baltimore, and we went out for a meeting. And after the meeting, Peter Barris, who was the managing partner just before me for 20 years, I guess called Tom McConnell, one of the general partners in our Menlo Park office, and said, "Hey, we had a pitch from this guy, Scott Sandell, and we're sending him out to see you guys next week, but see if you think he might be good for us." And so after the meeting in Menlo Park, Tom called me, and after a bunch of interviews, at that time, you would interview with literally everybody in the firm. And so at the end of all of that, they offered me a job right before Christmas in 1995, and I joined in January of 96 as an associate. And I think that's 26 years ago, if I'm counting correctly.
I mean, to make you feel incredibly better about yourself, I was born in June 96. So there we go. You've been in venture literally longer than I've been alive. I do have to ask this, but you know, I spoke to Blake at Divi, one of your founders, before the show. And he said that the role that your father's played on you has been instrumental as one of the highest ranking officers in the US Coast Guard. And so I'd love to hear, what have been some of the biggest lessons for you from seeing your father operate and how it impacted your mindset?
Well, you know, my father is definitely and one of my heroes, probably my primary hero. I grew up in southeastern Connecticut. He was an officer in the Coast Guard. As Blake said, he finished his career as dean of the Coast Guard Academy, where he taught in the math department for a very long time. What's so inspirational to me about him, he lived his life according to his values, and one of his values was excellence. And so he worked exceptionally hard and managed to always be, frankly, the best at just about everything he ever did. And that was noteworthy because he was so much better than a lot of people along the way, but he was still incredibly humble. You'd never get that out of him, not for a second. So I view him as a deeply honorable man. And importantly, as a father, he was just always there for me. He was a very devoted father and husband and still is. Thankfully, I spoke to him about an hour ago. He's hoping to get his COVID shot next week, but he and my mother live on Cape Cod. They've been married for 57 years or something like that.
Listen, I'm thrilled to hear about the vaccine, and that's incredible to hear about your relationship. Moving from something incredibly heartwarming like a father-son relationship, as beautiful as that is, to the cold, hard world of venture, which is a seamless transition for me to make. I do have to ask, you know, you mentioned obviously entering the industry there in January 96. It's been through such changes over the last, whatever that's been really, 25 years. I have to ask, what would you say is the single biggest changes, and what's been kind of some of the most challenging and the best?
Well, I was thinking about that last night, Harry. You know, I don't think it'll surprise you, but I really think the biggest change is the internet. The internet has changed everything. Even though we invest in information technology and healthcare, but the internet's even changing healthcare in dramatic ways. Telemedicine, healthcare delivery, the ability to amalgamate data across the globe on healthcare outcomes and use that in research. And then, of course, all the things we know about the way that the world is being digitized, none of that would really be possible without ubiquitous connectivity to all the devices that we know and love. And we can talk more about how the internet changed the venture capital industry itself, but I think the internet is the most fundamental thing that's come along in my lifetime.
Can I ask, what's been the most challenging change that's occurred?
To me, probably the most challenging thing is that if you go back to where I started, there were very few jobs in venture capital and it was a relatively small field. It seems like everybody wants to be a venture capitalist now. That creates some real exuberance and some challenges. At the simplest level, it's harder and harder to differentiate yourself as a venture capitalist when people will come along and offer valuations that might be, in your mind, sort of absurd. And so we've been facing this challenge now for a number of years, but it doesn't get easier. It just gets harder. And I really feel for the young people in the industry who are working really earnestly to learn the profession and to develop the skill set to not only evaluate investment opportunities, but to help entrepreneurs. And I think it's harder and harder for them to differentiate themselves, certainly than it was back in my day.
One thing that I struggle with is, you know, I've never seen macro crises in terms of, you know, crashes and busts in my investing career. Super interested in terms of that. Josh Kochman said on the show that it made him much more conservative seeing the booms and the busts. How now seeing multiple booms and busts, how's that impacted your investing mindset?
Well, you know, it's really interesting, Harry, because if you just go back 25 years or whatever it's been, there have been two big busts, obviously, the dot-com bust in 99-2000 and then the global financial crisis. And one of the things that seems a little frightening is that those things have occurred about 10 years apart. And the average venture capital investment is somewhere between 8 and 10 years nowadays. So you're investing every day with an investment horizon that probably realistically anticipates a bust at some point before you get out. And so that's a little bit of a frightening thing. I think the practical reality is that the only way you can deal with that is to be very careful with capital and always have enough capital to last a while should there be some kind of a bust, because typically in busts, the availability of capital goes away. Not only do valuations come down, but in the busts, usually there just isn't capital at any price. So you have to make sure you always have a reserve on your balance sheet. And I think you also have to have a business plan that allows you to make rapid adjustments to using a lot less capital for a period of time.
In terms of, like, you know, we spoke about busts there and we spoke about kind of capital intensity. I don't actually see it changing when you think about kind of interest rates at where they are today. And then when you look at kind of the large institutions really viewing early stage and private companies as kind of a hedge against inflation, it doesn't feel like it's going to change much. It's actually just going to increase the capital supply coming into the asset class. Do you think that's right, or do you think I'm actually missing something in terms of my analysis of the bull run?
We all wonder about that, right? We all wonder, like, what are we missing? It's not obvious, right? But then COVID-19 wasn't so obvious either. So I think we always have to be mindful of what we don't know, what we can't predict, and what may just come along that no one predicted. So sooner or later, there will be a macro event. I mean, you know, our LPs ask me that all the time. I say, nothing I can see would cause me to think that there's something around the corner, but I don't know. What I worry about is what I don't know.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you in terms of that, kind of worried about what you don't know. In terms of kind of the bust there that we mentioned, despite that, you know, you said before to me that it's an incredible time for the asset class. If we kind of dig into this, what makes you say about the incredible time for the asset class for you, do you think?
Well, I think there's two things, Harry. One is in the innovation economy itself, and then the other is in the private equity market. So let me start with the innovation economy. And this is what you and everyone can plainly see, which is that the world is digitizing itself rapidly. And actually, that transformation has accelerated with COVID-19, as we can all plainly see. And so if you think about it as the balance of power shifting from the incumbents to the upstarts, that's what I see happening every day in one new market after another, with one new technology after another. And I think the result will be that some very iconic companies are being built today that will be the Exxons and General Motors of tomorrow, or the IBMs. And we've already seen a handful of examples. The FANG companies have already shown us what kind of upside is available, and not all of them will turn out that way. But I think there's no doubt that some of the companies being created today will be enormously valuable and impactful over a long period of time.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you in terms of that impact over the next decade or so. It's interesting, we speak there for the asset class of venture. When we think about like the company building aspect, again, another thing that you said to me before, which I really wanted to double down on, was the core physics of company building have changed. And so when I was thinking about this, I'd love to hear your thoughts. What did you mean by this? And how have they changed so fundamentally?
Yeah, this sort of dawned on me, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago. It again comes back to the internet, really, I think, is the fundamental change which has enabled the physics of building companies to change. And I think it's why we see companies growing so much faster than we ever did in history. When I first hypothesized this idea that the physics of building businesses had changed, I looked at software businesses because I know software well. I had one of our associates look at the growth rate of software companies over 3 decades, the 90s, the 2000s, and the decade just ended. And I remember that in the 90s, which was the client server era, it was called, it was a heyday for software. And there were a lot of great software companies that went public in that time. But interestingly enough, in the 7 quarters after the IPO, the average company grew 18%, and that was considered fantastic. You couldn't get funded today if all you were doing was growing 18%. In the decade that followed, they grew 28%, and the decade just ended 50%, or something close to that. This is the average of newly public companies. And so you sort of have to unpack that and say, well, how could that be? And when you look at all of the different atomic elements of building a business, each of them have changed, and some of them have changed a lot. Just the development of software is now about 5 times more productive than it used to be. That's not because people are 5 times smarter. It's not even because the software tools are better. It's because of the foundation of primarily open source technology that's available that enable people to build on things that have already been built before, and in so doing, be much more productive. But I think on the distribution side, the physics are even more impressive. Again, look at open source software and the power of a free business model and the ability of a small company to give something of value away and suddenly dominate an entire market for a new category of software. And we literally have dozens of these in our own portfolio, and they're visible all over the place. The MuleSofts of the world, Elasticsearch and MongoDB and companies like that. And that business model of free, which I think is the most powerful business model in the world, is transforming one business after another. So I think those are just a few of the atomic elements, Harry. But if you look at any aspect of building a company today, I think you'll see that the physics are different.
In terms of those physics being different, it has driven obviously so much more capital into the industry than ever before, really. And I had Bill Gurley on the show quite recently, and he said that the oversupply of capital is really his biggest challenge today. Would you agree with that perspective? Or do you think actually the capital needs have just adjusted to the opportunities that are offered?
I think it certainly can be a challenge, but it's frankly also a wonderful thing in many ways. I mean, companies are staying private for longer. Even though it's cheaper to start a company, still takes a lot of capital to grow a company. And so a firm like Benchmark would be, frankly, in real trouble if there wasn't enormous amounts of capital, because they only do Series A and Series B deals, and they hope other people are going to come along and carry their companies after them. So I think it's a little ironic that Bill would be pointing that out. Certainly, that's more of a challenge for a late stage investor. But I think there's always a balance, and sometimes there's a little too much, sometimes there's a little too little. But the reality is that the time frame to liquidity has stretched out quite a lot. In 1999, it was something like 2.5 years from inception to IPO, and now it's more like 6 or 7, and at one point it was 9 or 10. And those companies that are being built are growing faster than ever, which, by the way, for most of them means they consume more capital than ever. So I don't quite agree with Bill. I think a related idea is liquidity. I think liquidity has been a challenge because when you stretch out the time in the private market, all the participants are challenged to be able to have holding periods that long. But on the other hand, those longer holding periods are precisely why venture capital firms like ours are able to generate much larger returns, because we're not giving those away to public market investors. So all of these things have two sides.
So the reason I love doing the show is because I get to ask questions that are totally off schedule, but I'm like looking to learn from. And as you mentioned liquidity there, and like Samuel Shaw said before, that like the next generation of early stage managers will have to navigate secondary liquidity markets very well in terms of returning cash to their investors, maybe pre-liquidity events traditionally. How would you advise, say, me, an early stage seed manager, in terms of thinking about liquidity events in the secondaries market? And how would you advise me with that respect?
Well, I do think that the secondary markets are really at an inflection point, and there's more and more capital flowing into the secondary markets. You know, we've seen it, of course, first for entrepreneurs. There's been a pretty robust secondary market available to entrepreneurs. And I think it's starting to become available to the venture firms themselves. And that will probably be, you know, an important way to manage early stage funds like yours. Our strategy is a little different because we have a multi-stage fund, so we can fund it ourselves. But I think it'll be helpful to everyone. Liquidity is a valuable thing, and it has been in very short supply for the better part of the last decade. And just in the last 2 years with the IPO markets really opening up, we're suddenly seeing that all these goodies that were trapped in the private markets are actually highly desirable and very valuable in the public markets, which, you know, I think is what has led to this SPAC phenomena that we might want to talk about at some point.
It is about the moolah in the cooler. I love that suggestion. I do want to also, you know, obviously with the oversupply of capital, that becomes real pricing pressure in terms of upwards pricing pressure. Another one that I'd love your advice on, bluntly, is like, how do you think about price sensitivity? How do you determine when to pay up versus when to remain disciplined? And what would you advise me with that respect with your learnings?
Well, I mean, I think the old adage that great deals are worth paying up for is true in any market, but that doesn't mean that all expensive deals are great. And so the tough thing is to figure out when to pay up and when not to pay up. But I think in an environment where there is this tremendous amount of capital and sources of capital at all stages of company formation today, you can assume that in almost all cases, great deals will be priced at what appears to be a premium at any given point in time. And so what I always do is I think about, is this something that's going to grow so extraordinarily fast that I will soon be very comfortable with this price? If it's a software company growing over 100% a year, and I really believe that that's going to continue to happen for some period of time, then I can justify paying a price that not too far down the road, maybe 18 or 24 months, or maybe even a year, starts to look cheap. I mean, that's kind of what I'm hoping for. But of course, even in this environment, we've seen situations where that sort of logic that served me well for a long time is completely invalidated by the fact that people are going to pay a price that I'm not going to be comfortable with for many years, even with extraordinary growth. So it's a tricky time.
That's a big challenge for me, which is like with the rise of preemptive rounds, the prices are often so high on my reserve allocations that actually it's almost suboptimal for me to allocate my reserves at this super high price rather than diversify with another 2 or 3 lines in the portfolio and concentrate capital at the super high price.
Yeah, no, I think where you're sitting, Harry, you got to be really careful about taking the precious capital that you have and letting your average price get moved up substantially. You know, you invest $3 million, let's say, at the beginning, and then your pro rata is $3 million in some super high price round, and you could have your average holding price go up by many multiples. And you just have to be careful about that. I mean, if you have a small fund, I think you want to be super sensitive about getting people who can carry the freight for a long time and not look for you to do your pro rata along the way.
Yeah, totally with you, Nat. I'm glad you said that. That was my strategy so far, but I've been questioning it. Peter Thiel's not doing the Series B for Facebook, and his quote about kind of always just pay up on that price still haunts me always whenever I don't do the reserves at the high prices. We mentioned SPACs though, so Scott, while I have you, I do have to ask about this. You know, the unprecedented rise, how do you feel about it? And I guess, how do you advise portfolio companies now who have this, although it's not an entirely new mechanism, the option of it is, how do you advise them on the option to do so? How do you think about that?
As I mentioned a minute ago, Harry, that I think one of the big challenges of our time is liquidity. And so SPACs are obviously a new form of liquidity for private companies. And frankly, what appears to me to be a new source of risk capital. These are people who want to to invest through this vehicle and ultimately be able to have near-term liquidity in the public markets, but seem to be relatively risk-preferring compared to the traditional IPO investors, or at least the traditional IPO offering method, if you will. So I think it's great. It's all new sources of liquidity are welcome. There'll probably be some exuberances and not all of them will work, but to the extent that they're a path to liquidity for some of our companies, I'm thrilled to see it.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you in terms of them being beneficial to all. I do want to dive into NEA a bit more though, because obviously NEA has scaled AUM significantly over the last decade, also scaled team size significantly. And when we chatted before, you said to me, there never seems to be enough money. And I know you've done some pretty intense data work from NEA's side on kind of portfolio company allocations and concentrations into the winners. And so if we start on like the capital concentration element, can you walk me through that? And how much did the companies raise over the last decade? Of that, how much did NEA do? What were your takeaways?
Well, what you're referring to, Harry, is the study we did over the last 10 years. We just looked at our growth investments and our conviction investments, which are two slightly separate things, but think of them as our best companies where we've deployed large amounts of capital. And yet, even though we feel like we've deployed a large amount of capital, this particular collection of companies has raised $32 billion in total, and we've only been responsible for $3 billion of it. So that's kind of great. Our companies have had access to all this company. The problem is that that particular basket of companies, which is a sizable basket, over the period of a decade have generated a return of 36% on average every year. So only doing $3 billion of it seems like we're leaving a lot of money on the table.
I totally agree with you. And this is unfair of me to ask. Does that mean you just raise bigger and bigger funds then? Is there this kind of asymptotic point where it stops being optimal, given the optionality there with the 36?
Well, I think there's certainly an opportunity to raise bigger and maybe different kinds of funds to meet these needs. And that's something we plan to do. But we've been growing actually relatively slowly, Harry, 10 or 15% fund to fund. We started with the first big fund, NEA 10 in 2000, was a $2.3 billion fund. So we've been growing on a large base since then. And our latest fund is $3.6 billion 20 years later. So it hasn't been an extraordinary growth, but we just look back and we think we've left a lot of money on the table and we can serve our companies and our limited partners better if we have more of that capital in our own hands.
You spoke about kind of the scaling fund sizes there. With the scaling fund sizes, obviously you have scaling team sizes and scaling partnerships, and decision-making is obviously kind of the crucial, most valuable element of our industry in terms of preserving it. In terms of like ensuring the same quality of decision-making, how do you think about preserving that quality with the increase in partnership size?
Well, first of all, the partnership has probably grown 50% in my 25 years. So it hasn't grown that dramatically. What we've realized along the way is that with these much longer holding periods and ultimately bigger capital requirements for these companies, you don't need a much bigger team to do this. But in terms of decision-making process itself, we are firm believers that the best decisions are made in relatively small groups. And since we have a relatively larger group and everybody wants to be in the room where it happens, so to speak, that's always a challenge for us. We kind of go back and forth between who gets to participate and not. But fundamentally, we try to keep group size to a relatively small level. One thing we came up with a few years back, because it was an idea of Chip Linehan's, I think one of our now retired general partners, something called a process decision, which is just to say all the general partners get to vote on the process, but they don't get to vote on the investment. And the process usually involves a significantly smaller number of people than the number of general partners. We have a dozen general partners, but the average process decision would empower five or six of them to make a decision. And the test that we're always looking for is that those are the right five or six people, that anybody in the firm would look at that five or six people and say, well, yeah, of course, those are the five or six people I want to have make that particular decision. And so we actually vote on process decisions every week, and then those teams go off and make decisions.
Can I ask, if you unpack process decisions, is it just the people in the room that are actually voting on the actual core asset decision, or is it a change of process as well? How does that, if you unpack a process decision, what's involved in it?
Well, a process decision empowers usually five, six, seven people to literally run the whole process and make the final decision and report back to the rest of the group, whatever they decided. What we do, practically speaking here, is we have two slots every week. They're an hour and a half long. The companies come in for an hour, and then there's a half an hour for the process team or the team that has the power to make the decision to meet by themselves. And it doesn't always happen in one session. These things might go on over weeks and weeks. And one other thing we try to do is we try to keep that same group of people for all the follow-on decisions that happen later for a given company. That way there's accountability down the road.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. And I like that in terms of being aligned for both the investment and the reinvestment decision. Speaking of those small groups of people, I spoke to Rick Yang before the show and he said, how do you think about rules versus guidelines when investing?
Well, I don't think we have a lot of rules. We have a lot of guidelines. Or said differently, almost any rule that we could write down probably deserves to be broken under the right circumstances. We don't live in a world of black and white. We live in a world of judgment and intuition and art and some science. And so we don't want to be too rigid.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you in terms of the rigidity. Plus, the other element that I always really focus on is that trust within partnerships. And again, like, it's very difficult to maintain such high levels of trust when partnerships are just a little bit larger, bluntly. What do you think is the secret? Because I spoke to Vanessa about this, and she mentioned the incredible chemistry that you have as a partnership and the trust that you guys actually have as a partnership. What do you think is the secret to retaining such trust within a larger group of people?
Well, obviously, we're careful in the hiring process. And the first thing that we look for that I'm sure everybody looks for in their organization is what we call fit. You know, is this person a fit with what we are? And we don't want them to be identical to who everybody else is already. We want to always be evolving and changing and open to new ideas and even to new thoughts and values. But what we do is once we've hired people, we're watching very carefully to see whether their behavior matches our values and our culture. And really, that's the one thing that causes people to leave NEA on a relatively premature schedule. Otherwise, we're a pretty patient organization, giving people time to develop. But that's the thing we stick to.
A little birdie told me that I should ask you about your lesson from Mark Carey on trust.
Well, Mark Perry, one of my favorite now retired partners and one of my mentors, we were just having a conversation, it might be 20 years ago now, and he posited that the only reason NEA could have scaled to the size it is because of the trust that we have in the partnership, which enables us to meet for 3 hours a week, make all the decisions necessary, and then have the confidence that they would be executed well. It really struck me when he first said it. I hadn't personally identified that as really the foundation, but then I realized that it was, and I realized that trust has a lot of dimensions to it. Among them, of course, integrity. But also, we trust our partners to know when they're not the right person to do something or they need help. We trust our partners to give it their very best effort and for the rest of us to know that things are being done as well as possible. All of those things are kind of part of the trust equation. I think trust is something we have to be very watchful to keep strong.
Speaking of the trust equation, you know, I do want to move to a kind of a segment on you. And, you know, obviously, a huge amount of trust has been placed in you as managing GP at NEA. And it comes with a lot of maybe non-investment related work, one would think. And it was, again, Rick, and I have to thank him for this. But he asked, how do you think about the role of managing GP today? And how does it differ according to different firms?
Well, we've always thought of the role of managing GP as kind of first among equals. The magic of a partnership is that it's not a terrifically hierarchical organization. And certainly the kinds of people who are attracted to work in venture capital firms are also the kinds of people who normally work for themselves. So if you have a light touch, you're more likely to attract, I think, people who probably would chafe under more rigid forms of leadership. So I challenge everybody to be a leader and give them the space and the opportunity to exhibit leadership and develop their own leadership abilities. And that works well for me because I also want to be an investor and that takes a lot of time too. So I try to celebrate other people when they exhibit leadership. I try to offer them the opportunities to pursue things when they see there might be ways to make NEA better. And I try to get out of the way as much as possible.
Listen, I totally agree with you in terms of what it allows you in terms of the investing side. And also, most importantly, often in many cases, the board side, which is a big amount of time that we spend in terms of our time allocation. I spoke to many founders that you sit on the board with. It was Ahmed, the one concern, who said about the transformational role that you've played on his board. And he wanted to hear, how do you describe your style of board membership? And how has it changed over time?
I think the thing that's been most profoundly obvious to me is what a courageous act it is to be an entrepreneur. And so I try to support that. And I try to walk in the shoes of the entrepreneur before I utter something to them that might change their course. And I always try to look at each situation fresh as it is on the day, which is to say, recognize that every business plan is dead the minute you start executing on it. And then you're facing new circumstances. And so when I get to a board meeting, I don't look at whether they miss the milestones, which of course I care about, but I look at how they respond to that and what opportunity sits in front of them, given where they are and what's transpired since the last meeting, and try not to be too judgmental about it.
Can I ask, you know, you've been on so many boards and so many impactful boards. When you look at, say, me in the first 2 or 3 years of their career as a board member, what would you advise me with the many years of hindsight and experience that you have?
You know, one of the things I did, Harry, when I was just starting out that was really helpful is I realized that one of the great things about the venture business is that you get to work with people in other firms. In fact, oftentimes you'd work less with your own partners. So I tried early on to, you know, if I was the Series A investor, I'd try to get somebody to lead the Series B who I thought was going to be a more experienced, great board member, and then I'd learn from them. Or conversely, if some really great person who I admired had done the Series A, I'd try to get on that board and learn from them. You know, I think every board is a learning opportunity. And then I try to check myself, and, you know, I like to talk a lot sometimes. So I just have to check that instinct and say, just listen. Let's see what other people have to say.
Totally agree with you. I think kind of listening, especially in the earlier years, is a core part. Final one before the quickfire. And it's like, we mentioned kind of the board member qualities there. And I spoke to Blake at Divi before the show, and he mentioned bluntly also how brilliant it is in terms of knowing when to get involved versus when to not get involved. And he also said about the trust that you have as a relationship of board member to founder. How do you think about building that relationship of real sincere trust between the board member and the founder, and what works?
You know, I think that just happens naturally, but I think it is especially helpful. You know, never step on somebody when they're down. We learned that on the schoolyard growing up, and I always think about that. When an entrepreneur comes into a board meeting and they've had a tough quarter or a tough month or something hasn't gone right, you don't have to beat them up over that. Just be kind, and they will always appreciate that. So that's a little bit there. I think in terms of advice for entrepreneurs, I guess it's easy to give advice, but I try to hold back unless I have a lot of conviction about it.
No, I totally get you. Is it tough now, given the compressed timelines that we have with fundraising? You know, before you'd really be able to build the relationship. You'd go for dinners, you'd go to the office, you'd meet wider team members. Now, with compressed timelines, with COVID, you don't have the in-person interaction and you've got massively compressed timelines because of the deal velocities. Is that tougher in terms of building that relationship of trust?
It is obviously tougher, Harry. There's no doubt about that. I think the thing that's been amazing to me and somewhat surprising is just how well we're managing to do it, you know, over Zoom. Who would have thought, let's say, what are we in? We're still in January, less than a year ago. None of us were thinking about this too much. And in the course of that year, we've learned all the things we can do on Zoom that we didn't think were possible, or we were at least very skeptical that they would be done as well as I think we're doing them now.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I remember the days when I was in the camp of, I would never make a decision without meeting the person. That would be crazy, right?
Oh, yeah. Every venture partnership had that discussion a few times.
So, no, I'm glad I'm not alone in that one. But I do want to move into my favorite, which is the quickfire round. So I see a short statement, Scott, and you give me your immediate thoughts. Are you ready to dive in?
I'm ready. Go ahead, Harry. Fire away.
Okay, so first one, what's the favorite book and why?
So for me, it's The Old Man and the Sea, Ernest Hemingway. I'm dyslexic, first of all, so I don't read a lot of books. I listen to books, but, you know, I'm very slow. I love to read, but I'm a slow reader. And Ernest Hemingway has a real economy with words, which I deeply appreciate. But in his final great novel, it's all about daring greatly and perseverance of the old man and the sea. And, you know, I think like all great novels, if you read it carefully, it just leaves you with more questions than it answers.
Yeah. No, I haven't actually read it, so I couldn't comment, but it is on the to-do list, to be fair. That and Man's Search for Meaning are two that I really want to read. But tell me, what do you believe the most around you disbelieve, Scott?
You know, in terms of investing, I think I just believe that we have the opportunity to invest in companies that can be enormously large and impactful and ultimately valuable. And most people don't allow them to believe in that possibility at the really outset. And unless you do, you don't select for the ones that really have that potential. And if they don't, you're almost certain not to get great outcomes. And so I really look for things that can be enormously large and impactful. And then I think the corollary is just to be patient and realize it takes a long time.
One LP said to me the other day, Harry, this venture thing, are you sure? Like, you've got the patience, you know, it takes a long time. And I looked at them and I kind of thought, you know, I've kind of got the time, to be honest.
Yeah, you do.
But it was a funny one. Tell me, what is the single biggest challenge of your role with NEA today?
I think the single biggest challenge is there's just one of me. I love the investing side. I love the managing and leadership side. And there are only so many hours in the day. So it's really trying to figure out where to use my time most effectively.
What motto or quote do you most frequently revert back to, Scott? You left me on a cliffhanger earlier, so I'm excited for this.
Oh, yeah. Well, so on my application to Dartmouth all those years ago, they asked you to pick a quote. I don't know how I came across it, but it's the Teddy Roosevelt quote that you've heard, I'm sure, before. It's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again because there's no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who, at the worst, if he fails, at least fails, while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat.
But it's hugely applicable to what we do. I love that one. I actually haven't heard that one. I feel terrible to say, but that's a fantastic one. Tell me, what do you know now that you wish you'd known at the start of your career in venture back in January 96?
Oh, it would have been nice to know that I was going to be successful. I mean, such a crazy, crazy career to embark on, you know, and it's just such a risky career. But I think the thing that I just loved everything about it. And so I never allowed myself to worry too much, but it would have been nice to know that it was going to work out okay.
When you look back at the time with NEA that you've had, what are you most proud of?
I'm most proud of not having a lot of regrets and living to my own values. That's really the thing I'm most proud of.
I love that one. Final one. What's the most recent publicly announced investment for you, Scott? And why did you say yes and get so excited?
I think it was announced the other day that we invested in a company called LoanPal in the middle of March last year. It was a day the market was down something like 3,000 points, which gives you pause, especially when you negotiated the price in December of the prior year. But it's a really, really exciting company. They basically have a system which enables them to finance solar loans for residential homeowners. They back about 40% of solar loans in the United States today. But I think what gave us the confidence is that they just have an extraordinary leadership team. And, you know, in the middle of March, we were fearful that the markets were going to be rough for a while. And so it was really a bet on the team, and they've done spectacularly well.
Scott, this has been such a joy to do. As I said, I wanted to do it for a long time. I've mercilessly used my relationship with Rick just to get this. So thank you so much for joining me today, and I really do appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure, Harry. Let me know if I can help again.
I mean, I just love doing that one with Scott, and such an incredible journey he's had with NEA. If you'd like to see more from us behind the scenes, you can on Instagram at hstebbings1996 with two Bs. I always love to see you there. But before we leave you today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans? This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carta makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll, and for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carta. Whether you're just starting out or getting ready to go public, the team at Carta can help. Learn more at carta.com. And speaking of amazing products with Carta there, Founders Fund's Keith Raboy believes that the best way to run finance at any growing company is to adopt Ramp, the fastest growing corporate card in America. Join thousands of founders and finance leaders at leading companies like Roman and 8 Sleep, cutting their bills by 4% per year and automating their accounting. In under 12 minutes, Ramp can empower your company to issue unlimited virtual and physical cards with built-in spend limits, 30-day payment cycles, and 1.5% cash back on everything you buy. Ramp is giving away a $500 welcome bonus just for 20 VC listeners. Just go to ramp.com/partners/20VC to receive the offer. Time is money, so save both with Ramp. And last but by no means least, SecureFrame helps companies get enterprise ready by streamlining SOC 2 and ISO 27001 compliance. SecureFrame allows companies to get compliant within weeks, rather than painful months. Join companies like Stream, Hasura, Benepass, and unlock more sales with SecureFrame. 20 VC listeners get a whopping 10% off at SecureFrame.com/20VC. As always, I so appreciate all your support, and I can't wait to bring you some phenomenal episodes next week.